On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
If you're interested in the well-being of whales, I strongly recommend that you stay tuned because a new film is just about to be released about the people who defend whales against, in particular, the Japanese commercial whaling fleet. And you're going to hear some stories, and the film is all about the battles on the seas. So stay with us. That's coming up shortly. My co-host for The Conversation Hour today is Victoria's former Health Services Commissioner, Beth Wilson, has, I might say, hobbled or limped into the studio this morning. Morning to you, Beth. What's happened?
Oh, well, it was 3:30 in the morning, and me, being the national patron of the Continence Foundation of Australia, got up to have a pee, went to the bathroom, washed my hands, splashed water on the floor, stepped onto the wet tiles, and down I went in a big pile on my shoulder. Shoulder's good, actually, better than it's been for years.
Sore shoulder doesn't explain the limp.
The limp is because I fell forward and my foot folded up under me.
Ooh.
And I had a very badly sprained ankle, but I had an MRI last week and discovered that I've got a little fracture. So that's probably why it's taking so long to heal.
Sorry, when did you fall over?
End of February.
And you had an MRI last week?
Yeah.
February, March, April, May.
John can count.
June, July. Why the delay?
Well, I had had x-rays, which didn't show anything. The MRI is much more intricate and shows it much better with contrast. Mind you, you back $390 for it.
So value for money if it finds out why it's not healing.
Well, I guess so. However, the
treatment...
Which you
just had it 5 months ago.
Well, the treatment doesn't really vary.
Don't they lock it up in plaster or something?
Oh, you can walk around in a moon boot.
You got a moon boot?
Yeah, I've still got my moon boot from last time.
Oh, dear.
But I turned 70 this year.
You did not?
No, I will. Not quite yet.
Oh, soon?
In November. I was born Melbourne Cup Day.
Were you?
Yeah.
Oh, who won that year?
I don't know, actually. I suppose it was me.
Your mum.
Well, yes, definitely. So I've been thinking a lot about how we age and aches and pains. No. Bernie Geary, my friend who used to be the Child Safety Commissioner, his grandkids call him Bomber. And the four-year-old said to him one day, "Hey, Bomber, how come you make all those noises when you get out of the car?" And this is happening to me now. Yeah. I don't mind getting older, but loss of mobility really surprised me.
Have you got a kind of, what, a coterie of ex-commissioners that get together?
Yeah, we see each other from time to time.
Have you got a name for it, the ex-commissioners?
No, but I might work on that.
Yeah, I think you should come up with something. You can get T-shirts printed up or something like that. Aging, yeah. Like the Ulysses Club. What's the slogan there? Age disgracefully or something.
Oh, I don't know what we do. We do have to have a veneer, at least, of respectability, given the important public roles that we all played.
Past tense.
Yeah. Oh, no, we still do stuff.
You do too.
Yeah. I'm involved with mental health still and chairing goodness knows how many committees. I'm on the board of Wild at Heart, which is a fabulous community arts outfit that brings the arts to mental health and people with disability. And it's absolutely inspirational. Love it.
It's a bit like, I mean, your attitude is that of lots of people who are on the, you know, politicians and people, many of whom say, well, I was offered generous superannuation on the basis that that would help me give something back when I was no longer tethered to the desk.
What's this offer of generous superannuation? I seem to have missed that one.
You were away that day, were you?
Yeah, I wasn't at my desk.
Oh, dear.
But I'm well looked after and I'm still earning quite a bit of money too, which is really helpful.
So you're lying on the floor, your ankle's starting to hurt, you're 3 in the morning.
And by this time, it wasn't just water on the floor.
Oh, dear. So, speaking of the Continence Foundations, so do we call an ambulance?
No, I just dragged myself back to bed. Got into bed much easier than I'd expected to, and then in the morning realised I had a really nasty sprained ankle, very swollen and painful.
Too late for ice by then too.
Yeah. But... I'm still mobile.
Well, it turned out it wasn't sprained. It was fractured.
It was. And my handyman, John, yesterday offered to loan me his dad's, you know, those scooter things old people have?
No.
You do, mobility aids. You see little. You see them racing up and down the footpath.
Oh, the little electric ones?
Yeah.
Oh, a little cart, like a golf cart sort of thing. Yeah, okay.
His father's passed on now, but his motorbike's still there, and John said, you can have that if you want. He said, but it does have one fault. It keeps crashing into people.
It does it.
It does.
Not,
that's
the,
what,
not the driver.
That's what Connie, his dad, said. There's something wrong with this. It crashes into people. No, Dad, you've got to watch where you're going and slow down.
Well, they are a bit. They can get up a bit of speed, those things.
They can. And in small country towns in particular where there's a high aged population, they can be very problematic.
So did you have a try?
Yeah. It was great.
Yeah?
And my mother had one too.
You're years away from that.
Oh, yes, yes, I hope. 10 years, I'll be 80. That's scary. Most of us don't think ahead like that. And we don't plan ahead for what's going to happen to us if we do become immobile.
No, because we don't want to have to face up to the prospect of it. We'd rather pretend that
it's not going to happen.
Something's going to happen, although our life expectancy is vastly greater than that of any previous generation.
This is true. My mother lived till 97. Mm-hmm. And had a really good life right until the end.
Not far into the distant future, in a month. In fact, my parents both will turn 93 in August.
Wow, your father is a world expert in zoonotic diseases, is he not?
He was, yes. He has a germ that he discovered.
Oh, yes, good.
Named after him.
Oh, no.
Yes.
What's that germ called, John?
It's a leptospirosis, leptospirosis fanii.
I read that. What is it? What's
Lepto is in the news recently. It was my father's kind of life work to be an expert in leptospirosis. He's a microbiologist.
Ah.
He was a professor of microbiology at Monash University, and he trained as a doctor and then went into research and teaching. And, lepto. Leptospirosis is a disease that affects, in Australia mostly, abattoir workers and people in those sorts of industries, but overseas it's virulent and it's potentially fatal, so yeah.
That's how I came across his work, actually. I was on the Workcare Appeals Board.
Okay.
And we saw a veterinary surgeon who had all of the symptoms of a zoonotic illness, like Q fever.
Or lepto or something
like
that.
One of those, yeah. And the the Workers' Comp Act at that time was unusually generous to people who had zoonotic illnesses or were suspected of having them,
mm-hmm.
because they're often hard to identify. But if you've got the symptoms and you work in the industry, you were deemed to have that illness.
Yeah.
And it was Solvay's work that we used to identify it. And what about your mum?
She was a physiotherapist.
I love my physiotherapist.
Yeah. So anyway, they'd hate the fact that I'm talking about them, so I better stop.
Oh, sorry.
Grow old disgracefully, Stephen from Kulwa has reminded us, the Ulysses Club, grow old disgracefully.
Oh, that's the motto.
You could call the old commissioners the Creeks and Moans Club.
Oh, that's really good.
Another text message, but anonymous, this one, so there we go. Well, I hope now that you know the cause of your discomfort that you're able to attend to it with some better results in the next 5 months than the last five.
Well, I hope so. But the doctor did say to me, it will get better.
Great.
And that's always very reassuring to hear that.
Can you just hurry up and make sure of that? It'd be my response. Our first guests, filmmakers, but also passionate eco-activists, Stephen and Alana. Stephen Amos and Alana Thomas have spent ages, in fact years, making a film about the Japanese whaling, commercial whaling now. They don't even pretend it's scientific or research, just straight out commercial whaling, which is back on the high seas, and those who are determined to stop them are also back on the high seas, which is what their film is all about. It's called Defend, Conserve, Protect. Stephen, Alana, good morning to you.
Morning, John.
Thank you very much. How did you get involved in this, Stephen, first of all, with you?
I'd been doing a bit of work with Sea Shepherd a number of years ago, and I was doing some, some videos, some commercials, and they knew I had a background in film and TV, and they said, look, we've got a whole lot of campaign footage we've been sitting on. We don't quite know what to do with it, and I know they had an interest in maybe doing some feature work. So I ended up taking all the footage and we shot a whole bunch of other footage to go with it, and ended up putting it into a, you know, documentary feature.
And Alana, how did you get involved? Because you've actually been out on the seas as well.
I have, yeah. So I went out the year after the campaign that the film's based around, so 2013-14, and I went out as a camera operator. But, yeah, Stephen got me on board as editor, and together we went through all the crazy amounts of footage and pulled the film together.
So how long were you at sea?
I was at sea for 4 months on my campaign.
And what did you
see? 100 days all up. Oh, it was an incredible experience.
Which seas were you in, first of all?
Oh, you travel down to Antarctica, so in the Southern Ocean, yeah. Just seeing the huge cathedral, like icebergs, whales right in front of you, penguins. Yeah, just incredible experience. And then, of course, the action that you face when you come up against the whaling fleet, it's quite incredible. But, yeah, you get to see all that in the film, and it sort of shows the day-to-day life of what you go through.
Okay, for the purpose of making it more interesting, instead of four people furiously agreeing with each other, just for the record, I don't like whaling, but let's put it to the test. What's wrong with the Japanese taking the old whale here and there?
Well, for a start, it's in Australian waters, so it's illegal.
Well, that's where the whales are.
And, they're a protected species, so...
I think if, from an environmental point of view, I mean, whales for millennia have always been connected to the stability of climate. So, you know, you can take like 12,000, you know, pilot whales, and together with their kind of fecal plumes, you know, they'll take care of 400,000 tonnes of CO2. So they've always been tied into the, you know, the stability of climate, which is kind of, you know, obviously with them. You know, I mean, many of them have been facing, you know, extinction.
So. But there's more than ever. And since whaling pretty much died out, there's more whales in the seas than anyone's ever seen before, to the point where, you know, you've got to say, well, you know, it's like crocodiles. They're everywhere. It doesn't matter if you sort of grab a few and knock them off.
And I think, I mean, for me as a filmmaker, the power of the film, you know, it's an anti-whaling film. It's, you know, it's about saving species. But it's also, you know, the power of the film is that it's told from, you know, passionate activist points of view. That's what I found like really personally interesting, is that, you know, it shows people really, you know, stepping out of their comfort zone and going out and kind of making, you know, some kind of environmental change.
I think stepping out of their comfort zone's an understatement.
Absolutely.
It looked hellishly dangerous. Tell us what that was like.
Oh, well, for me personally, on my campaign, yeah, it is very dangerous at times, but you go down there with that understanding that you're taking that calculated risk. But, yeah, certainly there was a moment for me when I was filming on my watch where the harpoon ships came out of the mist and were coming right at me. And I literally, yeah, I thought it was going to ram the ship right where I was standing. And you have to make that choice of, what do I do? Do I get out of the way, or do I dig my elbows in and keep filming? And I kept rolling, and it turned a metre before it hit the bow. So,
wow, well done.
Pretty hairy experience, but that shot got on news stations around the world and, you know, gained a lot of exposure for the cause. So.
It's a very dramatic documentary. Mm. And you say it's anti-whaling, but it's certainly pro-whale, and not just the climate change issue, which is important in itself, but also to the ecology of the whole ocean. And there's some pretty amazing underwater shots.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So a lot of the whale footage was shot off the Barrier Reef. So the minkes come down and, you know, they migrate down south. So they come right down through the Great Barrier Reef on their way to Antarctica. So most of that whale footage we actually shot off the Great Barrier Reef.
I did wonder.
Harvey Bay's the great nursery, isn't it?
That too.
Up in Queensland?
Yeah, and we shot just off Cairns and Lizard Island. But, I mean, it's an amazing experience to be underwater with the whales, having them come up to you. And I think that's one of the points we try to make in the film, is that, you know, I think in 100 years you look back and you go, I mean, they've got the biggest brains on the planet. You know, some people, including Paul Watson, considers them, you know, probably more intelligent than people. I mean, they're incredibly, you know, they've got really advanced social structures. They're very, very similar to humans in many respects.
They have an extra lobe of their brain that's just dedicated to communication than what we have.
Well, the first time I saw whales was down at Warrnambool. Mm-hmm. I was at a drug and alcohol conference, and I took the afternoon off to sneak down and see if I could see any whales. Wasn't properly dressed for it or anything, and there was a bunch of people there not talking to each other, just watching and hoping. Mm-hmm. And then the whales arrived and the whole place was totally transformed.
Yeah.
People who didn't know each other were grabbing each other, talking, excited, sharing field glasses. Look, look, there's one over there. I was nowhere near prepared for the emotion of it. It really moved me.
Yeah, they're incredibly intelligent, and I do think people will look back and see them. You know, this is some kind of murder. You know, I mean, they're, you know, just because they can't speak. You know, in you know. With
yeah. Well, human they do language, speak so. To you because yeah. they certainly communicated to me.
Yeah.
David Stratton said in his review of your documentary on the weekend that because of the missions that you've been on, 6,000 whales have been saved. So it's not really just knocking off the odd one, John.
No, but, I mean, whale numbers, I'm trying to be, you know...
Oh, yeah. I understand that, so I'm having
oppositional
back.
For the purpose of making it more interesting. I want to make that abundantly clear, although if someone wants to quote me out of context, out of the transcript, I'm sure they can embarrass me phenomenally. But the point of it is whales have become almost a symbol of conservation movements, have they not? They've almost become emblematic of a particular mindset.
Oh, look, they have, but I think, I mean, just in terms of Sea Shepherd, not that I can, you know, really speak for them, but you know, in my opinion, I mean, you know, they're out there, you know, off the coast of Africa, they're doing all these different campaigns with anti-poaching, you know, it's all tied into, you know, kind of fisheries collapsing. I know in this particular film we're focusing on the whales, but, I mean, the UN came out, you know, 10 months ago, and they said, look, we've got the humans have got 12 years to turn things around. And, you know, the UN are non-alarmist. They came out with this very, very dire report. And it's not just, you know, turning things around in a simple way. It's like overhauling every major industry because, we're on the, you know, on the brink of environmental collapse. And, you know, this is just, you know, this film shows one kind of component of that.
And it shows the passion of the volunteers too. These young people who understand, are intelligent, educated and determined to do something about it. That comes through very strongly.
Absolutely. And, I made this, you know, unashamedly for my daughter. You know, she was 14 when I started this, you know, and I wanted to make something that was inspiring, that you know, it was kind of optimistic, not pessimistic, that, you know, encouraged her to kind of step up and other kids like her.
And daughters have been very important in the history of anti-whaling. Remember, Malcolm Fraser's daughter changed his mind about it.
Okay, so that led to an attempt even back then to do something about it. But I guess the issue with Sea Shepherd, if I remember correctly, split off from Greenpeace, is that right?
Well, Paul co-founded Greenpeace with Robert Hunter, and when he got a little bit too radical for the organisation, they kicked him out of it.
When Paul got too radical?
Yeah, he went off and set up Sea Shepherd.
So he wanted more direct intervention, and Greenpeace became more lobbying, and even after Rainbow Warrior, it kind of, you know, retreated a little bit, didn't it, after the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior? So, I mean, the idea that you take the law into your own hands is itself controversial, isn't it, that you just say, well, I don't care. I'm not leaving it up to governments. I'm not leaving up to, you know, the United Nations or the Anti-Whaling Commission or any of those things. I'm just going to go and do what I think needs to be done. That's surely we've got to talk about that mindset. So you've been out there with them, Milana. So do you take the law into your own hands on other issues that you feel strongly about too?
Ooh, putting me on the spot there.
Because what the Japanese are doing is illegal. So that kind of balances it, John.
I guess it's filling a void, isn't it, where governments fail to act. Somebody needs to step up and fill that void.
So it's the same with some of the, let's say, the vegan activists against farms who invade a farm and release animals who they say shouldn't be held because we shouldn't be eating animals. No one should. So is that the same mindset?
Look, I think, I mean, we're still arguing in Australia politically whether climate change is even real. I mean, it's really, really insane when you've got the majority of scientists around the planet saying, look, it is.
Oh, and Tony Abbott got voted out at
Well, luckily.
No, the current government do not deny global warming. They do not deny climate change. That's not, we've got to accept that as a matter of government policy. They're just not prepared to do as much as some activists are calling on them to do.
Absolutely.
But they don't deny it.
It's, and, you know, it's look, you know, it's the Wild West out there on the high seas, you know. Mm-hmm. You've got tankers, you know, the Sun Laurel, a big orange tanker. That's illegally down there carrying all that fuel. Mm-hmm. You've got all
to
the,
refuel
all
the hunting to ships. Yeah,
absolutely.
So there's no doubt what the Japanese are doing, they shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. We won in the international court. We took them on. We won. They're not complying. We should have sanctions against the Japanese. Mm-hmm. But isn't that a political issue rather than one for pirates and activists?
I think, you know, what this film is all about is people power and taking a stand. And I think it was Margaret Mead that said that a group of thoughtful and committed people will change the world, and it's the only thing that ever has. And sometimes I think that's what it takes, and we're at that stage now where it is really important for everyone to stand up and take action. If you look at all the studies and, you know, the science behind what the state of the world is, like, now is the time to stand up. And
And if you go back to that UN report, I mean, it really, the time for debate is kind of over. It's like, you know, yeah. And if governments can't act,
we're reaching those tipping points.
Or won't act.
Then people have got, I mean, we're seeing it already with the kids, you know, you've got these movements like the Extinction Rebellion, and whether people agree with it or not, you've got individuals, you know, thinking that they need to step up and take control where the governments can't, haven't been able to do that.
Yeah. I remember years and years ago, I was walking down a jetty and the Rainbow Warrior, I think the second one, was moored there. And the daddy was coming along with a little four-year-old girl. Mm. Where are we going, Daddy? We're going to see the Rainbow Warrior. Mm-hmm. What is it, Daddy? It's a really, really famous boat. And it was really great. I thought, what a great daddy.
And I've got a baby coming in a couple of months. And when he's older
like
and says...
Of minutes,
yeah. But when he's older and says to me, well, what did you do to try and, you know, help the world when all this was going on? I'm not going to say to him nothing. I'm going to say I wasn't passive. I took responsibility and played my part.
Did you get any injuries?
I did actually cut my forehead open when the ship rolled. I had a headbutt with the edge of a table, so I had a few stitches, but that's it.
Okay.
Nothing major. Just giving me an impressive scar.
Which is
well to brag about.
Well hidden too. I'm not sure if any of you saw, there was an article I really enjoyed in the newspaper on the weekend about people who are starting to make recipes for restaurants out of pest animals.
Really?
So feral animals, deer, rabbit.
Wild boar,
but also things like some of the invasive sea stars that have a roe that's highly prized. Why aren't we harvesting it? And they're calling them pestitarians.
Love it.
Instead of pescatarians, which are vegetarians who eat fish. So pestitarians. So is there the opportunity for us to make an assault on invasive feral animals and invasive species, introduced species, by turning them into a commodity? And then people will hunt them because there's a commercial return in making them available, and we should be eating our way out of some of these environmental problems. I loved that approach. What do you make of it?
Innovative. It's great.
It's definitely innovative. I don't know how... Well, the game must be healthy if they're all, you know... It wouldn't be too toxic, I can imagine, if they're serving it in a restaurant.
Might be a bit hard to get your kids to sit down to a sea starfish.
No, it's the roe from the starfish. If you go, I don't know, I've seen this in Italy, you know, that sort of, it's a delicacy. It's highly prized to catch those animals and harvest the roe from them. Mm. And here they're a terrible menace in the bay and elsewhere. So instead of trying to eradicate them, we should try and hunt them.
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
It comes down to awareness, I think. As long as people are aware of what they're putting in their mouths and what impact their actions have, I think that's the most important thing.
I've just come back from a holiday where we were mostly up in the Northern Territory, and the feral buffalo, although a lot of people are fond of the buffaloes now as a feature of the area, but it's totally introduced, feral buffalo, feral horses, camels, donkeys, pigs, obviously the cane toads and frogs, and on it goes. The introduced species that are squeezing out the native wildlife are just a massive issue.
Yeah.
Massive issue. So anything that could be done to, you know, get the camels out and all the rest of it, it's just urgent. It's got to be done. Got to be done.
I have eaten a camel.
All of it?
The hump. They had a hump on display at Paran Market. And it was kind of like all fat, just a lump of fat. Ugh. At the end of the documentary, one of the young volunteers is looking terribly unhappy and distressed and saying, we failed, we failed. What was that all about?
There's a sequence in the film where one of the harpoon ships tries to refuel. They need to refuel. Actually, this gets back to your question, John, about, you know, danger. And the sea ship tries to blockade the refueling. So if you can cut their supply lines, you know, the ships have got no choice but to turn around and you know, go back to Japan. But there's a scene in the film that gets quite hairy, yeah. where the ship, the Sea Shepherd ship, blockades these two ships, but they end up backing down. It gets too dangerous. They don't want to rupture the hull of the refueling ship, and so they back off. But it's a great, you know, it's a great example of what Alana was saying, you know, about you know, just very you know, controlled.
How many ships were doing the actual filming?
There was four ships. They had about 10 cameras on each vessel. There's a whole bunch of GoPros. So we ended up with like thousands of hours, like literally thousands of hours.
There's always someone filming at every hour of the day because you film in shifts.
Yeah.
So you don't want to switch. Always someone with a camera.
Yeah. Because you don't want to miss the moment.
Yeah, because it could happen at any time. Yeah. So when I was on there, I'd do it 12 to 4 p.m. and then the 12 to 4 a.m. and then you rotate. So there's always someone filming. So mammoth amounts of footage.
Yeah, you don't want to miss anything.
A lot of it of nothing.
Yes. Yes, well, that's what most of the campaign is, waiting, but we, you know, you condense it down into this exciting film, but, you know, some of these confrontations
and
can
it
go
is an
for
exciting
9 hours.
Film. Yeah, I think exciting, and you're on the edge of your seat watching it and asking all the questions that John's rightly pointing out.
Yeah. Well, that confrontation at the end of the film, you know, I mean, that goes for about 10 minutes in the film.
Yeah.
I mean, that took place over 2 days. With numerous attempts to refuel. So, you've got the big floating abattoir down there, the Nishin Maru, which takes the whales from the harpoon ships and, you know, processes them.
But you didn't really see dead whales in the movie, just one, I think, from a distance.
That's right. And we tried to make it PG, so it's a PG film. Mm. We've tried, you know, it's not that graphic. It's more human drama.
Yep, definitely.
And, you know, it really made it again, you know, for kids to come and see and to, you know, to feel like they're empowered when they leave.
Text messages galore. Tony in Fitzroy says, hunting and harvesting game for restaurants, what a great idea. And someone else says, yeah, that'd be a pestarunt.
Oh.
Boom, boom. Feral horses, smart and edible. Export them free-range horses to Europe. In Tasmania, they're starting to eat roadkill. It can be feline terrain. Someone else says feral cats and dogs. Huge problem. Absolutely right. Craig in Healesville says, eat more feral deer. It'll stop them destroying my car again. So excited you've got these eco activists on. Can you get the Maker of the Land version as well? Says April in Torquay. It's a bit like the feral geese on Lake Dalesford, says Vic from Hepburn. Marion says, like you've jokingly said that there's no one. You've jokingly, selectively quoted comments for this convo. Tony Abbott has never denied climate change. He's always just challenged the manipulative hysteria of marketing by those with vested interests in selling their climate change panic.
Sorry, Johnny.
Marion says, you should acknowledge that. Marion, Tony Abbott said climate change is crap.
And I was just going to come in as the patron of the Continents Foundation and make that point.
Yep. And sorry, Marion, I have to disagree. I'm happy to read your message out, but I'll disagree. And what are we going to do if the Japanese come here and tell us we have to stop killing kangaroos? So there's obviously a lot of interest in this, in which case people will go along and have a look at the film. It's called Defend, Conserve, Protect, narrated by Hollywood star Dan Aykroyd. It's released on July the 25th. Alana Thompson and Stephen Amos have been our first guests on The Conversation Hour today, with Beth Wilson, former Health Services Commissioner, my co-host. We're all joined in the studio by Dr. Susan White. She's a geneticist at the Royal Children's Hospital, and she has drawn on her experience from the clinics to get involved in an exercise of health literacy of a particularly different kind. How do you communicate with young people about some of the complex issues? The best way is to write a book that they might read and better still enjoy. Dr. Susan White, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
Congratulations on Take the Shot, which is as much about basketballers' genetic diseases. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, Take the Shot is a novel for young YA readers, so maybe the 11 to 15 year age group. And it's a story of a basketball obsessed teenager who finds out he's got a rare genetic condition
called
Marfan syndrome.
How rare is it?
It's in the... I live in the world of rare diseases, so everything's rare to me, but Marfan is one of the more common rare diseases, if I'm allowed that qualification. So it's in the realms of 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 10,000 individuals. So,
and what does it do to them?
It's a condition that affects your connective tissue, so it affects the way that ligaments and tendons in the body are formed, makes them a bit stretchier than they ought to be.
So you get these really tall, gangly kids.
Tall, yeah, strangely it affects the body shape, is what, that's right. So people with Marfan syndrome tend to be tall, lean, with long fingers, long limbs, and I guess none of those things on their own are particularly medically worrisome, but it has some serious medical complications associated with it because the aorta, the tube that takes blood from the heart, can be wider than it ought to be, and if that's not detected and treated, that can rupture.
And then...
Well, if that happens in the general community, that's usually a lethal event.
So if your aorta ruptures, you die.
You don't usually survive.
And if that happens in the middle of a basketball game...
Yes, that, you know, I guess it depends on what resources there would be, but, you know, typically the aorta is a high-pressure vessel. It's like a high-pressure hose rupturing.
So your typical parent of a Marfan's disease kid would say, uh-uh. Sorry, you might think you'd be the perfect tall, gangly kid for basketball, but you're not playing.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of conundrum and one we face in the hospital where we meet these tall young people and often a key passion of theirs and a sport that maybe makes them feel more included and involved is basketball, where they're very suited to that with their long limbs and their great height, very good at slam dunks from an early age. There's some risks associated with that, and it's not a straightforward issue. There's clearly positive things that come from playing sport, right? For all of us to be physically active, particularly for a teenager, particularly a teenager who maybe is confronting a few issues about their self-esteem and how they're included socially. Sport can be such an important way for them to feel better about themselves and feel included. And I guess that's a theme I really wanted to explore in the book.
And you've done that really, really well. You've juggled all those balls brilliantly, I have to say.
Nice one, Beth.
When I first got the book, I thought, oh, 300 pages of adolescent basketball. This is going to be a bit of a chore. However, I got to page 198 before I stopped reading in the first go and absolutely loved it. And then I decided I needed to have a second opinion. So I asked my neighbour, Otto, who's about 12, I think he is, Otto Langtry Kearse, will you read it for me? Because he's tall and gangly and he's crazy about basketball. And he's having a year where he's not really interested in books. He's finding there's not much to grab his attention. But he liked your book so much that he's going to his librarian and recommending they get it for their library.
Are you torturing your neighbours?
My neighbours are lovely neighbours. They run Ladro Restaurant.
Can't advertise for them on the ABC.
Yeah, of course I can.
No, you can't.
I'm hoping reading the book wasn't a form of torture. Exactly.
Not at all. Otto said that he thought you got the point over really, really well. I said, what did you think of her using as her hero, somebody with Marfan syndrome? And he said, well, the issues for him are the same as the issues that are facing all kids.
Oh, that means a lot to me, Beth, because that's exactly what I was going for. And in fact, really a lot of the emotional themes and content in the book relates to how I felt as a teenager. And clearly I don't have Marfan syndrome. I'm pretty short and dumpy. But
you're too hard on yourself.
But I remember a lot of feelings about not really fitting in, not really knowing my place, wanting desperately to be like other people. And what I really wanted was to talk about Marfan syndrome and raise those conversations about differences, but also to universalise, if that's a word.
Yeah, well, because when Bug is walking around his new school ground, friendless, trying to pretend that he's not alone, that's just so common for youngsters. I remember that. People ran when they saw me coming. No, you handled it really, really well. It's an exciting book. I think the role of teamwork in it is fascinating.
And the social relations between teenagers. But what you're all doing, whether you're making a film about whaling or whether you're writing a book for young adults about genetic disorders and fitting in and all the rest of it, you're trying to communicate complex ideas in ways that'll attract people's attention. Essentially, that's, I mean, here you are, you're a kind of rarefied specialist in an area where most of us just don't understand anything, but you're busting it down to the simplest possible language. That's not an easy thing to do.
No, and I guess I very much wanted it to be an appealing book. I did, you know, there is a real risk when you're talking about genetic conditions and differences in appearance that the book can come over as a bit earnest or preachy.
And that's the same with a film about whaling.
Right, and I really didn't want to write a book that people didn't want to read. I wanted it to be engaging and funny, and in that I was just following the voice of my main character, who fortunately for me kind of came out as a 14-year-old funny guy.
So, Stephen Lanner, how do you avoid being preachy in a film that by and large is going to be seen by people who are in furious agreement with the whole purpose and point of it?
I think the trick of it is to just drive it through a really strong point of view. I mean, I didn't necessarily want to make the film as a piece of polemic, you know. So I think the power of our movie anyway is that it's shot from a very strong point of view, and I think that's that was my way into the film, and I think that's what kind of gives it its power and inspiration.
But it's not made for doubters, is it?
Look, it could be. Again,
it's almost a fundraiser sort of thing for Seashell.
Well, it could be perceived as that, but, you know, I kind of made it. You know, I mean, anyone that's, you know, when you watch the film, when I was, so let me digress, growing up, I used to see a whole bunch of films and you'd leave the cinema really upbeat and empowered. You felt like you could go out and kind of take on the world.
Like what?
There was a whole bunch of films
Hood,
growing up.
And
yeah. But you get less and less of those.
You just dated yourself big time.
Yeah, and you get less and less of those films these days. And I really wanted to make something that really did inspire and empower people. And I think it actually manages to do that. I think it, you know, presses those kind of buttons.
It does.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, well, a whole lot of Disney films are like that now. They've got echo messages in them. We were watching Moana with our granddaughter the other day, and she's 2.5, and she loves it. And that's all about the environment and
brilliant.
The sea and all of those
sort
of things.
This is real.
This is real.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're going to get into all of this soon if you're having a baby. Yeah. Well,
and as is your book too, Susan. I was really interested in how the spectre of the coronial processes took such a long time to resolve in this book, because it can take after a death up to 2 years before people get a result and they get re-traumatised through that. Perhaps you could tell us about that in your book.
Yeah, so in my story, Bug, my main character, his father is involved in a workplace accident that's being investigated as a sort of a subplot. I have as a writer, I have a bit of a thing about crazy subplots, and fortunately my editor pruned down 100 crazy subplots to just only a handful. So there's a story going on in the background for the dad, which actually in the end ties into, without giving too much away, ties into the dad's diagnosis of Marfan syndrome. So this condition runs in families. When a person has the condition, they have a 1 in 2 chance of passing it on. I had an inquest going on in the background, and Beth, I actually don't have a lot of direct experience of that inquest world. Certainly in my work as a genetics doctor, it's a pretty separate field, but I did a bit of sort of digging around to try and check, and it did seem like things could go for months to years, which was kind of convenient because I had all these other subplots to resolve in that time. So it could sort of grumble along for me while I did the other work that I needed to do to draw the thing together.
And it resolves really, really well. Of course, Abraham Lincoln had Marfan, didn't he?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, and there's a basketballer in the US who I wrote into the book, but he is actually a real person who has Marfan syndrome, and he was diagnosed, I think, around the time of his NBA trials. So it was an incredibly difficult time to get a diagnosis like that. There's probably other individuals playing basketball professionally who are undiagnosed.
How does a geneticist and deputy clinical director of the Clinical Genetics Services for Victoria, how do you find time to write?
I am quite a driven person. And
is that in your genes?
Possibly. I think my parents would want to take credit for that, whether it's genes or environment. We could argue the toss.
Match nurture, yeah.
Yeah. I write early in the morning before my kids get up because sometime around 5 to 6 I would start. And I often only write for half an hour. I'm fortunate if I talk to lots of writer friends, they need a real block of time to immerse themselves in their creative work. I have quite a short attention span, so I'm quite happy to dip in for half an hour and write, and then the kids and the dog get up and all hell breaks loose. But I do have a day a week. My Thursdays are my writing day, so I kind of stick to that, and I am quite...
John mentioned in your genes, one of the things I thought the book handles really, really well is emerging sexuality in young men, and he refers to his bodily parts as the team in the shorts.
Yes.
Misbehaving themselves when he's too close to a girl.
Yeah, it was a bit alarming to me how easily I slipped into the mind of a 14-year-old boy. It wasn't something that I knew I actually kind of had as a voice. And when I had to talk about, if we're honest, and I really wanted the book to be honest and authentic, those are the things that matter enormously to me and probably more than anything else, I knew I had to talk about, the issues around early sexuality. And
positive thing there too, although the team in the shorts kept acting up and with the potential of really embarrassing bug, He questioned it with things like, what is the matter with me? But he was also in control of it. He could make the team in the shorts behave themselves.
Yeah, I don't know how well that extrapolates to real life, but having not had a team in the shorts in that exact way.
I don't know about that. I think girls have their own team in their shorts.
Well, that's true. It's just a different team just another team.
Not as obvious.
It's going in a direction I did not expect.
Yeah. Not as obvious to the casual observer.
That is true, yeah.
And not only do you find time to write, but you found time to study writing.
Yeah, I studied at
How
RMIT.
Important was that?
Hugely important because I was, I loved writing at high school and then lost it as something that I did when I got into medicine. And I really imagined that, right, I'm going to be a doctor, could see this sort of box for myself that I was going to fit into. But in my 30s, I just felt this yearning to be able to do something creative, and studying writing at RMIT was just so empowering because I had no confidence and I didn't know if I could even write a short story, let alone a novel. And I had some key teachers who really nurtured and honed what I did have, and they really helped.
And the incomparable Claire Renner comes in for a thank you, as she does over and over and over again. Graham Stimson, I mean, so many people who say that RMIT creative writing course and the people there really introduced me to a whole side of myself that I didn't even know I had. Congratulations. Dr. Susan White, who is the Royal Children's Hospital's geneticist, deputy clinical director of the Victorian Clinical Genetics Service, and has somewhere along the way also found time to write an adult fiction book called Take the Shot, about a young boy with Marfan's disease who basically lies to everybody so he can play basketball because he loves it. Take the Shot, published by Affirm Press. Stephen Amos and Alana Thompson have contributed to the making of this extraordinary film, Defend, Conserve, Protect, narrated by Dan Aykroyd, which must have been no small thing, so congratulations there. Beth Wilson, former Victorian Health Services Commissioner, has been my co-host. Thank you for coming on your ABC. This has been The Conversation Hour.